Why are police photographing our license plates?
What are we doing for veterans returning home damaged physically and mentally, suffering from depression, homelessness, and suicide?
Why did the Supreme Court deposit corporate money into our electoral process?
Should we redefine middle class as working poor? Or is it just another Wall Street merger?
What's really behind new voter picture ID laws in certain states?
Why aren't NBC, ABC, CBS, and Fox asking these questions?
Welcome to the Reasonable Voice Blog Talk Radio. I'm Marcello Rolando, and the mission of the Reasonable Voice and the Reasonable Voices working together on our Blog Talk Radio shows is connecting the dots between politics and finance, need for education, humanity and world peace, and the arts, which we then gladly provide our listeners, the voting public, as informative food for thought to provoke their self-determination and appetite for equal opportunity. The Reasonable Voices are advocates for mental health, prioritizing education, preserving our history, leading by example for a peaceful and prosperous world, embracing creativity and political unity as solutions. Charlotte Glenn is my guest today. She is the director of Rachel Is. How are you, Charlotte?
I'm good. Thank you for having me on.
Fantastic. It's my pleasure. It's a challenge in that having seen the film, which, by the way, tell us when it's going to broadcast on PBS.
So it's broadcasting tonight at 8 p.m., and then there'll be subsequent times that I'll screen after. But tonight is the premiere at 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time.
And that's Tuesday, May 6th. Very good. All right, then. I have to say, as many know, I certainly have had to deal with mental health issues in my family, with both my parents and my brother. So, but mental health issues have many faces. You know, we know mostly of these days of Alzheimer's, dementia, schizophrenia, depression. But we forget that. That's not all there is to mental health issues. And I think this video, again, the video is Rachel Is, and the honesty of it, I mean, it's more than a day in a life of, let's face it. So why don't we start out, Charlotte, with your telling us what your relationship with our star and why you decided to make a movie about her.
Well, Rachel is my sister, and the film follows her last year at school. So we started shooting on her 21st birthday, which is the age when individuals with developmental disabilities lose their rights and services as youth. So it's as children. So it's this like majorly transitional time period for individuals with disabilities and then also their family members who are planning for the future. And so as Rachel's sister, as my mom's other daughter, you know, sort of seeing what was happening in my family's life, I knew that I needed, this is the film that I needed to make. I made a short documentary about Rachel. It was really a portrait of our relationship. But with this huge life change that was happening, seeing an injustice, I felt like the lack of supports and services and for individuals and their families with disabilities, I just knew that it was a film that I had to make, a story that I wanted to get into the world.
Well, it is a powerful story, and it's not all a sad story. It certainly is traumatic, but it also has moments of lots of moments of love, and not just happiness but fun. You know what I mean? When you see, again, as I said, I've been through this with a different mental illness in my family, but as I had to always, when I heard this in your film, I went, ah, yes. I often had to say to caregivers who, you know, change through the years, that and to family too, you have to love who's there. You can't be remembering someone who used to be and wanting them to be that. You have to love who's there. But in your case, as you explain in the film, I should let you tell this, initially, you know, when all this happened at a very young age for you, you didn't think You didn't know who was there. You never knew another Rachel, yes?
Yeah, I mean, Rachel was born with an intellectual impairment, and she was born when I was almost four. My life before her was pretty limited. I have a couple memories.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
When you grow up in the community, when you're a sibling, that you experience disability, I experienced disability, I experienced my sister differently than my parents because my parents had a life before Rachel. I didn't, really.
Yeah.
And so I think having Rachel as my sister has really formed and shaped who I am.
Yes. Yeah. How, I know your mother said something that in the film, and I don't want to give away too much. I want people to see this. They need to see it. We too often as a society, I mean, historically, there's such a stigma with people with mental illnesses. And now maybe there's a little less of that. But at the same time, we are now, all the argument about Obamacare or Affordable Care Act, but everyone's talking about physical health care. When do you hear anyone say anything about mental health care until there's some kind of violence? So it's an important film to see, to understand, just if for no other reason from the standpoint of funding, as you pointed out earlier. Funding stops, and without this situation, this condition, this mental health issue is 24/7. It doesn't stop, and it's the demand on the family. But I know your mom said something I've thought many times, if I never said it out loud. She didn't want to be defined by Rachel's life. And I have some theories about the title, which I think is fabulous. But how did you go through a period where you just didn't want to be the other sister or defined by I'm Rachel's sister instead of I'm Charlotte?
Yeah, I think that I've never, even when I was making the film and even after the film, that I never thought about myself. I never felt defined by Rachel. It's actually only been in the last couple of years and having this film out in the world and talking about it that I realized how she's impacted me. But she's always just been a piece of life.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's been important for me to realize how she's impacted. I never wanted anybody to feel sorry for me. I didn't like any of the sort of, that people feeling, it must have been so hard. I never felt like that. And mm-hmm. I never wanted to think about the impact that Rachel had on my life. But ultimately, I think the impact that she's had has been one that's made me a filmmaker, that has, it's having empathy, it's seeing the individual for who they are, that everybody is different, everybody has their own needs, everybody has their own way of perceiving the world, and I don't think that I could have, I don't think that that's the way that I would think about things if it wasn't for being Rachel's sister, and growing up in the community, growing up with her, with like her friends, and going to her schools, and just being part of that community.
Yes. You mentioned earlier, too, that at 21 years old, the funding stops. But there's another thing that happens in the film, I think it's quite clear and honest, is that also at 21, if not before, Rachel starts to express a very strong desire to, like anybody who's 21, she wants to get out of from under mom's roof, wing, literally and figuratively, and she wants to live on her own. She wants to have friends. She wants to have a roommate. And talk to us about the process of that, if you will.
Yeah, there's these, for people with developmental disabilities and people who rely on government support, which is, the money that's needed to help people have independent lives, You know, unless you have millions of dollars, it's just not a possibility. So just to contextualize, I think a lot of people think, oh, you must be, this is only really poor people. Like, no, this is most families are reliant on services, really. You know, but for Rachel, she always expressed, I mean, I think starting from like 17, she started to tell my mom that she wanted her own apartment, that she wanted to live away from her. I mean, it's something that everybody in our family has expressed. You know, we really at the same age too, you know, 17, 18, that's the time to leave. So it wasn't surprising that Rachel wanted that as well. And she was really very vocal about it. So the tensions between her and my mother really started to increase because of what she wanted, which is to not have my mom tell her what to do anymore.
Yes. And you know, what's so strange about that, you know?
Yeah, I mean, the most fun that I've had at screenings is showing the film to high school students because I was hoping to tell a story that would be both specific in talking about disability, but also talk about universal issues, you know, the universal issue of us trying to find ourselves, and Rachel definitely wanted her independence, and she was very vocal about it.
Yes. As you know, as is any teenager, you reach a point in high school. I remember, frankly, and my parents were just absolutely wonderful. I loved them. They were incredibly supportive. They had no experience with having someone want to be in the arts. I started out on the viola when I was in elementary school, and then it was piano in middle school, but by high school it was theater, it was and then when I as an adult it was soap operas I was on, so but until my mother saw me on TV, they never stopped saying, when are you going to get a real job? But my point is, at high school, I just always assumed when I graduated from high school, I would go to college, which I did, and then in college, I'd get my own place to live, and that's what the rest of my life would be, and it turned out that way, and I just think there's so many, the connection, it seems to me, between those who have mental challenges and those who are lucky enough to have other kind of challenges, the connection is that there's, as you say, there's still that universal truth. There's still that basic core of what it is to be human. There's still that drive for wanting to communicate and to share a life with someone and joke and hang out. And so Rachel was really expressing a truth for everyone, yes?
Yeah, I think that's really well put. I mean, and I think she also expresses, you mentioned some of the funnier parts of the film, you know, she expresses some of the frustration that we all have.
Yes.
With just everyday life. She's a very expressive person, so.
She is. And
I found, like that people really, really connect to that.
Yes, she's very expressive and at a high pitch and volume and to be heard, and also and the honesty. That's what got me. I hate to sound like an old cliche, but the honesty, not only the truth of your being willing to put your family on camera, but the honesty of Rachel. I mean, everything that comes out of her mouth is the truth that she sees it and feels it in that moment. And who's, you know, we're not used to that kind of honesty. How is that?
Yeah, I hadn't thought about that. It's true. I think there's a lot of honesty in my family. I think all of both my parents and my sister, I hope I can say the same for myself, that we deal with and try to address things as they are and to confront life as it is. So, I mean, it's something I strive for in everyday life and in my work.
Yes.
I hold honesty to a very high regard.
Well, moving back to your mother for a second, she... is it your impression that your mother did established a structure for Rachel, and I guess that structure, of course, had to include you. But there was an extra, of course, extra needs for structure for Rachel that may not have been as necessary for you. But she had set all of this in place, and then comes the graduation, and then Rachel's desire ever growing to want to be out. How did the family, your mother in particular, and Rachel, of course, how did the family get a new structure for Rachel? If she wasn't going to stay at home, what was the process?
Yeah, well, the film follows that process of looking to build a new life for Rachel. So a life that would post-school, so one where she would be able to work for Rachel and her disability, working in a sheltered workshop was, we felt, the most appropriate and would be the most rewarding experience for her. And then, of course, looking for placement in a group home or community living arrangement, as they're called in Pennsylvania at least. So that's the film follows that journey to try to find those two things, and the struggle coming from the lack of funding, the huge waiting list for people with disabilities. So I guess right now in the country it's over 200,000 people who are waiting for supports and services to allow them to live independent lives, which is pretty insane. We live in the United States, and these are the things that families in the community are faced with, and some people in pretty dire situations. So. I don't want to give away the end.
I understand, yes. And I'm avoiding that too.
No spoilers. So that was what we were up against. There was a lot of suggestions about what might people thinking there might be appropriate situations for Rachel that ended up not being so appropriate. So there's a lot of sort of zigs and zags in this process that we followed in the film.
Yes. I do want to dwell a bit on the number you threw out. I was going to ask you about that. There are over 200,000 people in the United States of America, not the third world, 200,000 people, Americans, who are waiting for some kind of social assistance. And, I don't think people necessarily expect the government guarantees them a home, but I'm often, when I speak publicly, I question why people think, what do you think government is for? Is it just to make war and to take taxes so they can make war, or is government there to protect and defend and look after its people, give them a little helping hand? Nobody is suggesting that we all become totally dependent on the government, but as you say, everybody does it. I mean, we never question when an oil company gets a subsidy, or a huge farm corporation gets a subsidy, or politicians. There are times in people's lives with certain challenges where the government needs to be a part of the solution. And with 200,000 people with developmental disability waiting to, and all they want is to be able to live independently, to have some independence. There may be some things they can't do, but there's a lot one can do. I mean, watching the film with Rachel, again, her logic always makes sense to me. she knows what she wants, and and she doesn't have a problem expressing it. How is this weight going for you as a family? This, I guess it's a huge uncertainty. How is it and other things that happen to us in life, they must impact particularly heavily on Rachel and those, you know, close to her family and friends. How do you deal with that?
Yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, just to talk about these waiting lists in a more universal way,
yeah.
You know, that the waits, what it means in reality is that people graduate from school, and then so they have structure and they have a place to go. I'm like now quoting the film.
Yes. It's a good quote.
Yeah, so they have a place to go. The school, and they have a community and friends,
mm-hmm.
and then all of a sudden at 21, that's gone.
Yes.
The floor drops, and so for many, many people, it means waiting. It means just sitting at home and with nothing, no access to friends. A lot of people can't drive if they live in rural or non-urban areas. It means they have no access to people outside of the people in their house. The impact that has on their caregivers is immense. If somebody can't be left alone,
yes,
and now there's no school. So this, you know, we're talking about, it's not just a luxury. We're talking about some like pretty serious quality of life issues.
Yes.
That this lack of funding has on individuals and their family members. So it's a serious issue, and it's really sad to think about the fact that we live in this country where there's this community that's still marginalized to the point where this is happening. And so, I mean, through the film, I really wanted to talk about these issues. I wanted to bring, and I wanted to bring visibility to a community that I think doesn't have the visibility that it should. Because I'm hoping, and it's my dream, I think, as a filmmaker, is that by telling these stories, that it helps to bring humanity to a population that is marginalized and misunderstood often. So I'm hoping the film does that. And through doing that, there can be movement to alleviate these huge waiting lists.
Mm. Well, I certainly hope that for you as well. I don't know. It seems so incredibly short-sighted to think that once a person who needs your support turns 21, they no longer need your support, as if miraculously now everything's fine. And so thank you very much for the 21 years, and here I go. I'm not being facetious. I just can't quite get my head around why any agency or organization that is whose mission it is or desire or responsibility to be of assistance thinks that 21 is a cutoff age. It's like, you know, you're 21 now, you can drink, so you don't need our help anymore.
I mean, I know, it's like totally, it seems slightly arbitrary.
I know, and I'm glad you laughed, because I thought, oh gee, that sounds so like I'm trivializing or being flippant, but I'm not. I'm just trying to understand, because I must admit, you know, when I suddenly was thrust into being in charge of three lives, they were all adults, and two were 20 years older than I, and that sort of thing. So it was different. I had had, unlike you, I had had a life knowing them very differently. And in any case, I just wanted to take a moment to give special thanks to Charlotte Glenn, the director of the film documentary appearing on PBS World Channel. The title is Rachel Is, and it is a look into the puzzle that is developmental disabilities, and it's an honest portrayal of her own family and her sister, Rachel. So I hope everyone will tune into it, and we are now going to take a break, and when we come back, we will have more to say on this and other matters. Thank you so very much for tuning in to the Reasonable Voice Blog Talk Radio. Don't go away.
Well,
Welcome back to our Reasonable Voice Blog Talk Radio panel discussion. I know we've talked about education before, but you can't get educated if you don't know about education. I recently had a wonderful guest who I didn't agree with on all his politics, but I certainly was impressed. He's a police lieutenant, Joe Flamini, and he brought up some great points. And I think there are two, at least, inequitable issues when we look at our educational system. I mean, there's a lot that we need to look at, but let's look at these two things, at least with the panel today. Michelle Opperman, Bernard Hankins, and Daniel L. Garner. I'm Marcello Rolando, the Reasonable Voice. I'd like to talk about, when we talk about economic equality, let's talk about what sports people get paid as opposed to what teachers get paid. And then that other thing is, what is this? We have to improve mathematics and science in our schools, but the other things, not so much. Who wants to start?
I wish I had time to do this whole poem that I have. It's called Sports Science.
Do some of it.
And I don't have it on the top of my head.
Okay.
But basically, it talks exactly what you're saying. It says, you know, when you're in school, your parents want you to be smart, but your friends want you to be popular. And so all of this striving to be smart in your mind at that moment means nothing because it's not getting you anything right there in that moment. But then slowly as time goes by, you grow up, you see your parents were right. Why? Because, oh, you're the engineer, you're the Mark Zuckerberg, so now you're the billionaire. But not always, because the celebrities still kind of, you know, get the attention too. And by the end of the poem, I basically just kind of weave together how, like in another panel, we were talking about how business and art should come together. I was talking about how the body and the brain are both equal. They're both needed because if you're the doctor, you work on the athlete's body. If the athlete hurts his knee, what do they say? Oh, your career is over. You should have been a doctor. But you know, the athlete's like, oh, but you can't get any girls. I got all the girls. You know, so it keeps going back and forth just to show you that there is nothing that is more important than anything else. The brain is as equally important as the body because, well, the body can do nothing without the brain, but if there's nothing to house the brain, the brain would be in a test tube, a bat dead. So using that as a lens conceptually, that is the importance of athletes. I don't think, you know, because I think athletes can feel kind of demeaned too. It's like, oh, they're dumb jocks. But they're like, who's coming to, you guys are coming to watch me play. And
so
all the ticket sales paid for your engineering department, you know. And then, but the engineering department has its own prestige as well. So we have to really validate both people. And I think it's important to do that because we all are supporting society in our own ways.
Well, I was just thinking about how when I was in like 6th, 7th grade, we had to write a paper, and I you know, came up with a thesis. I like remember it like it was yesterday, but I wrote down I wrote out the sentence, and it was my thesis, and I came and brought it to my teacher, and you know, my thesis was essentially, I wanted to look at why teachers were paid so much less than athletes, and you know, I was pretty young, and she was like, that's really sweet, but you have to do it about, like, one of the books we read this year or something, you know. And I was just like, I mean, it made sense. I was being completely out of the parameters. But I think that it's always, like, dawned on me as a big question of, like, I don't understand exactly why it is that there's such inequality between salaries, you know, between different professions and things like that. Now, sports are great. Like, you know, I'm nothing against sports, but there's a huge industry. It's almost like the wedding industry. I'm planning a wedding. There's a huge industry behind, like, weddings and all of that, which isn't necessarily bad either, but the commercialization and the fact that we have television, I think that goes into why sports become such a big, you know, part of, you know, one's daily life, one's weekly life, you know, and the fact that it's captivating and we can sort of watch this game and get, like, you know, it's almost like they would watch the Gladiators. You know, it's something to kind of feel the passions that you may not necessarily feel in other areas of your life, or be able to have it be more explicit. Like, they're against those people. I'm against some other people too. But we can't like play a football game and get over it. But anyways, I think that commercialization of sports is often what has like inflated it so much. But it's also like it just proves that this is what like people want apparently, right? Because it wouldn't be a big industry if people didn't want it. And so it's like, that's saying less about the sports and the athletes than it is about us, like as citizens.
Exactly. Well, we are convinced that we want it. I mean, some of us are. I'm not. But I think also, in all fairness, initially, the owners, and the owners are still an issue, notwithstanding Sterling, but the issue, owners were making the money from the ticket sales initially. And I know this because I watch a lot of Ken Burns, not because I'm an expert in sports, but I love history. But the players were paid nothing, zip. That took a long time, just... And that was for the white players. It took much longer for those people who weren't white to be get pay and whatever. So, so yes, it was. And so then the thinking was, by the time we paid athletes, after all, they can be hurt and they cannot play like opera singers, for instance, or engineers or doctors well into their 70s. They're going to have to stop at a much younger age. Therefore, we pay them a lot up front. Yes, but it's gotten well out of hand.
Well, if teachers don't like having athletes make so much more than them, then seeing that 90% of sports are out of schools, all they have to do is stop hosting sports. Everyone's love of sports comes from the schools, actually, because the schools are the ones that have the teams. I can't think of really any teams that aren't linked to a college or a high school unless they're professional. So at the same time that the school that we're as a society, and many people agree with this, we're valuing sports over schools, we have the sports at the schools.
Which means it simply starts earlier than professional ball.
That's correct. And also, too, you didn't teach kids, since they are dealing with the pressures of being cool, you're saying choose sports or education. So you're creating a dichotomy. You don't mean to be suggesting that dichotomy, but you are. And seeing that school is taught is not fun a lot of times, or at least how it's taught, you're always going to go with sports. Of course that's what you're going to want to do.
So then you're with drama.
Well, good for you. Well, the schools don't play up the arts like they do the sports. That's actually part of our creative, the loss of creativity in our country. The arts are extracurricular.
Yeah.
And sports, although they're classified as extracurriculars, are more like this kind of deity that kind of looms over it all, because the cool kids are the artists. The cool kids are the football player. And that's also, too, the thing is the community, most communities, the thing they look forward to the most is the Friday night football game. Mm. And football is the kind of all the sports, that's the big one. And from that, it trickles down to making all the sports sort of more important than education. I think, too, when it comes to the question of... when it comes to the question of teachers' pay and athletics pay, like Michelle was saying, the society has a value for the football, but maybe if the schools were to separate sports from education, we could start changing that.
It's an interesting concept. It really is, you know.
Well, the other thing I was just thinking about is, you know, like I said before and what Daniel was talking about, there's a sense that when you do sports, there's an immediate reward. Mm. You know, you make a touchdown, the crowd cheers, everybody sees you, your name is in the paper. But if you're the scientific kid or the artistic kid, that's something that takes a little more time. You have to work, you have to go to your lab, to your room, and you have to spend time working it out. And that reward doesn't happen until maybe 4 years later. Mm. So there's a desire to want to get that popularity now, to get that approval now, so you're more, you know, inclined to do what is immediate and delayed. So the money, I think, comes into play with that, too, because you're saying, well, people praise this, and when people praise something, they're willing to put money towards it. Mm-hmm. But you don't really see big rallies like, science explosion 2020. You know? It reminds me of this show called Sliders that used to come on about these people who could slide into different dimensions.
Oh, yes.
But it was the same Earth, different dimensions. So one of the episodes was like everything had reversed. Like sports was considered reading and science. But there was like math bowl, and these athletes were catching balls and answering questions.
That's hilarious. That's hilarious.
Well, as long as there's which doesn't happen often here, a slight pause. I'm going to mention, do a little promotion here that we should support artists, and obviously I feel that way, but I want to mention one in particular, Erica Arvold, who owns Arvold. She comes from California. She was the Virginia casting director for Spielberg's Lincoln. She's from Los Angeles. She's worked with the big boys, as she would say, through Chicago. She's now in Central
Ifigenia, and is just finished casting Turn, which can be seen on the AMC channel on Sundays at 9 p.m. She has been a wonderful guest on our Blog Talk Radio. And also, I'd just like to say her new project is very environmentally oriented. It is about the Chesapeake Bay, which is part of the Mid-Atlantic culture, certainly Maryland and Virginia. And you should go online and find it. It's Arvold is the name of the company, I forgot how to spell her name all of a sudden.
A-R-V-O-L-D.
Yes. Hey, spell it for me, Brian.
A-R-V-O-L-D.
Yes, sorry. I'm the one who knows her. A-R-V-O-L-D. Arvold is the name of the company. And the new movie project is Chesapeake. Do what you can to help them make it. It's you'll be impressed. Now, but we're still here. Let's keep talking.
Yeah, I am. Something that I was thinking about, like, with sports, what Bernard said about, like, the instant gratification of sports is, like, you know, when somebody makes, like, a three-pointer and everybody claps.
Yes.
You know, like, woo! You know, when I finish, like, a hard, like, math set, nobody's clapping. Actually, I'm kind of like, I would love to finish my homework now so I can go to bed, you know? Mm. And I think there's, like, there's something about that that I think plays, like, a huge part into why we value certain things over another. It's like, you know, it's just, as humans, it's just so much easier to consume and to, you know, just be gratified and then just to be in that place. It's easier. It's just, you know, and we're a little bit lazy as humans. Our brains are even lazy. It'll always do whatever it can to use the least energy, you know. So to expand and to, you know, do something that's not going to be understood right away is always, you know, more challenging. It's, I think education should help us value it, though. Mm. Like, value both. Value sports, value science, value, you know, drama. Mm. And the other thing I was thinking about is I nanny for a family, and the youngest of the kids, she's so sweet. And I said, you know, she was feeling sick, so she couldn't go to school. And I said, how did you feel about not going to school today? And she said, oh, I don't know. But sometimes it's fun to not have to go to school. And I said, oh, well, do you like learning? And she said, well, I do like learning, but I mean, learning's kind of like with math, and I don't really like math very much. I don't really like to have to learn in that way. And I was like, well, watching Frozen, a movie, and learning all the songs is still learning too. And she's like, yeah, but it's not math. So I don't really think it's learning. And I thought that was like such an interesting, you know, she's 6 years old. It's such an interesting, like, to me, revelation of how kids see learning as doing something they're not, that they don't necessarily,
like
exactly, they don't like to do, or it's hard, or they don't get necessarily out of the way. And so just wanted to share.
Well, first, sports are wonderful. I did wrestling, cross country. They have a fantastic function. I think they teach character. They can, at least. The question becomes, when you integrate sports so well into school, and at least don't make, it just blurs the value system, and that's something to be aware of, and how, what that looks like, we have to investigate, too. The school system since like the beginning of the 20th century has been math and science heavy. I mean, everyone's acting like we haven't been math and science heavy. It's always been math and science heavy. And obviously that emphasis hasn't worked. And one of the reasons for that is because math and science is presented as opposed to creativity, music, and all these other things versus integrated into. You get extraordinarily excited about, you know, the Finnedays, the Glicks, the Von Neumanns. I've read all these. I didn't major in science because in doing the work and the creative process you want to, you get into economics, you're learning the Black Swan Theory by Tlaib, and you're like, ooh, I want to know the Chaos Theory, and then you get into Meslow, and then you're getting into all of science because one thing leads into the other and becomes exciting. But I remember my high school classes and think, wow, this is boring, and I hate this. And also, too, the thing that is really silly about how we do science today is because I can look up all the answers in 5 seconds on my BlackBerry. So what the heck is the point? That's the main feeling in math and science classes that keeps people, it feels like labor for the sake of labor. Yeah. And so then everyone looks at math and science as just silly because it's like, I'm learning about something I could figure out in 1 second if I wasn't in an artificial school environment. Well, you know, Neil deGrasse, I can't say, he does the Cosmos, so he's a great guy. You know, he's like, he just kind of laments how science is presented as boring. Yeah. Well, if you're saying, hey, kids, figure out how to create an alternative energy source that's going to, you know, save the world, and then they're, like, figure it out, well, they're going to go into any avenue they can to find the answer. They're going to go into design science, and suddenly science becomes the avenue of problem-solving versus getting a grade. And I think if you switch that up, everyone's going to love math and science.
It's like forcing, I used to teach history, it's like forcing kids to learn dates in history as though then they've learned something.
Right.
But I want to give a defense statement. I wouldn't say I'm a sports lover. I'm not. I grew up with family that, you know, it was on the television, and then we had to go somewhere where we'd literally turn off the TV, get into the car, and turn it on the radio. So I'm not a fan. But all the guys, because that's who was playing the sports during my time, but all the guys who were in shows of mine in school when I was a director or a teacher or at camp director or whatever, I went to all of their games. And I went because, quite selfishly, because by supporting them, I knew they'd want to be in the shows. And they were always great in the shows. But I never cheered as much as I did for my guys who were in the plays when they hit that ball or did that touchdown. So yeah. I do support what's great about sports, and I do think both a large part of the problem with violence in schools today comes from eliminating recess and eliminating the arts and some of the outlets for physical activity like sports. And now suddenly there isn't that.
Right.
We don't get a release from the competition of sports, and we don't get a release from recess, just being able to hang out and talk with your friends, and you don't get to sing a song or, you know, be in a play. And all of that, what does that leave you for school?
Yes.
It's memorizing dates and being locked in a science or math class. And I'm not trying to be trivial. I'm not trivializing the violence in school today. I'm just saying, as we've said before, as Bernard said in other panels as well, we need to treat the whole person. We're nurturing mm-hmm. the whole human being. And when you take out chunks of it and just leave, what do you get?
Well, just a quick comment. When you create a sports structure, you indirectly say that all physical activity that's not in a sports structure is therefore just kind of a waste of time.
Yeah.
So then you have health problems. Arguably, people should become more athletic
yes.
as they get older, but we've got it the reverse.
Right.
You're young
Absolutely.
And then you stop.
Yeah.
And so I think that's another sort of value thing that should be switched around.
Well, I'll end on final few things. One,
okay.
kind of what Daniel was saying about you're telling kids, well, there's a lot of confusion, basically. One of the lines I have in the poem that says, your parents and society tell you that science and engineering is what's most important, but the sexy woman on the billboard tells you the truth. I mean, because honestly, it's like your parents are like, go do this, pursue this, but they see what people praise.
Sure.
Yeah.
So they're not stupid. They're like, you told me to go towards what people praise. This is what they praise.
Mm-hmm.
The billboard woman on the beer ad.
Mm-hmm.
Popularity rules. That's what I want to do, Mom and Dad. So they're not dumb kids.
Mm-hmm.
They're just doing what you told them.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing is, I read a book recently where he made an interesting point. He said, money and morality have become so linked in the sense
that
the less money you make, the more moral the job that you do is.
Mm-hmm.
So you're an artist, you're a teacher, you're Mother Teresa. So then, in a way, you start to justify becoming paid less because you say, well, I'm not making a lot of money, but
that
I'm doing something good.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's mm-hmm. another thing that's gotten to our head about how much money is made versus what you're doing. And the what was the last thing I was going to say?
Let me throw out this and maybe to remind you. It's all in the marketing too, folks. I mean, we bear responsibility for being overweight and for eating the wrong kinds of foods and destroying the environment. We do. But it is in the marketing. If all you're hearing on television and radio and the internet is that XYZ is what you wish to aspire to, then you're going to aspire to it until you start going, wait a minute, maybe that isn't the only thing I should be aspiring to.
So I do this hip-hop club with these kids that this teacher runs at this high school. And she says, you know, you have all these kids who do hip-hop and, you know, freestyle rap, and then their other classes, they're failing. But then she brings them after school into her club, and all of a sudden they're rapping. They're like, Odysseus and Artemis Fowl. She's like, the stuff is getting in their heads.
Mm-hmm.
It's not that they don't listen and aren't getting it. It's just they're not being given outside of the structure of math, reading, science only. But you have kids who have different ways of thinking.
Mm-hmm.
That
and
are
expressing
not,
it.
Yeah, they're not permitted in the classroom environment to express it. But so then they're seen as unintelligent. It's like, oh, you didn't get it. It's like, no, I got it. You don't get it.
Yeah.
You know, I'm doing it because she really validates me. She's like, you guys are geniuses. You did that on the spot and connected the dots. I could never do
exactly.
that.
Exactly. Connecting the dots is my big thing. I love it. It's like telling Michelle she couldn't write on the paper she wanted to write on in
right.
sixth grade. All right. That's why teachers don't get paid as much as sports people. That's not... That's not the way to end. Just kidding, everyone. Glad you tuned in to The Reasonable Voice today, Blog Talk Radio. And you know all of us, Michelle Upperman and Bernard Hankins, Daniel O'Connor, and The Reasonable Voice, Marcello Rolando. Thank you. Stay with us. We'll be back. Maybe not today, but we'll be back.
Hello, I'm Marcello Rolando, The Reasonable Voice, thanking you for joining us and becoming one of the reasonable voices heard around the world. A load of presidential crock. One unknown unknown is how low those mentally altered by greed have taken our republic in the name of patriotism, homeland security, and the Citizens United Way. We really do need stronger mental health standards and requirements for occupants of state houses and the Supreme Court, if not Congress. If for no other reason, those who torture remain free, whether Russian, American, or corporate presidents. Why we did it. Corporations still banking on depleting energy resources, racing against mothers and nature to deny clean air, water, and terra firma to future? Or maybe just fear of Oro in the Oval becoming a new family value? So we did it. The right bombing the wrong, falsely accused, Iraq, dictating homeland proclaim, we who are about to die salute the unknown knowns of the mushroom cloud crowd. Forget birth certificates. How about presidential mental health certification? We did it. Saluted Vietnam War President Lyndon Baines Johnson while shunning Middle East peacemaker who actually entered Teddy's arena and though marred by an unspoken malaise, politically bloodied by dust-choked helicopter's rescue attempt in Iranian desert sands, strove valiantly to bring home 52 Americans held hostage for 444 days. Yet, the city on the hill we built that award goes to delaying freedom of Americans until presidential inauguration January 20th, 1981. Secrets, lies, and hypocrisy are not strange bedfellows at the intersection of 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue and Wall Street, where the pursuit of happiness, money, and power commingled, intoxicating the mentally warped long before GW or GM. Mindlessly following Pac-Man's breadcrumbs from Gulf of Tonkin to weapons of mass destruction myths, we hail to the chiefs of corporate America war criminals. Not originators, but like Cheney and friends, fabricating their variation on the theme foreshadowed by Himmler's I.G. Farben. It's not new. Predating Franklin and Adams insisting Jefferson declare our independence from such as these, the law of the land was inequality for women, human slavery, and wealthy landowners paving the way to a Paul Ryan budget with governors refusing citizens the benefits of the Affordable Care Act. The LBJ administration was beneficiary of presidential assassination and the civil rights law, a politically embarrassed 87th Congress. True, JFK was a Johnny-come-lately to presidential civil rights action, but inspired to political courage by Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., President Kennedy was the architect of government-proposed racial equality, and not the Vietnam military-industrial complex bullies who, 4 days after Dallas, replaced NSAM 263 with NSAM 273. Why they did it? Perpetual war profits? Mental illness of banks crippling education with student loans, and voting rights going right back where we started from. The gap in mental health in elected officials, born of society's gap in informed voting, is as anti-American as any gap in economic opportunity, leaving America vulnerable to corporate-induced bully side. Join us. Become one of the reasonable voices heard round the world.
Thank you for continuing to listen, support, and share The Reasonable Voice with your friends. We are now accepting offers for your company or organization to advertise with us and welcome new sponsors to The Reasonable Voice. To apply, please email us at thereasonablevoice@gmail.com.
Thank you for joining us today and every day and recommending us to all your friends, both online and offline. And please download our downloadable podcasts. I am Marcello Rolando, The Reasonable Voice, hoping you will become one of the reasonable voices heard round the world.